problem between Professor Osiatynski and them, and he's therefore gone to pick them up. But I believe we should begin. This is the place where we normally hold the forums of the Miller Center, and it seems appropriate for what we want to do this afternoon. I'll say these few brief words, and then Professor Alf Mapp will take my place, and I'll retreat to the outer reaches with my students. Mr. Miller, when he gave the funding for the Miller Center, initially had the notion that at the University of Virginia one might be able to create an institute similar to the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. And he held to that idea for some years. And then he raised the idea of what he called a gathering place for men of wide experience in public affairs and ordinary citizens, men and women, good practical sense and wide experience of their own, who would come together for a dialogue. This morning we had a series of three formal presentations and lectures. This afternoon we have only one such formal presentation, but we do hope that in the 5 or 10 minutes comments that our three panelists will make, that they will inspire you in turn to raise the kinds of questions that we've grown accustomed to in the discussions that have taken place in this room. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Mapp.
Thank you, Ken. Dr. Michael Edward Brent, our speaker, has as his subject French constitutionalism, liberalism, and democracy. Of course, this is a topic that involves very much the spirit of the Enlightenment, the scholarship of the Enlightenment, and the events of the Enlightenment. And his background and his interest and his activities make him peculiarly appropriate for this role, because his studies growing out of the Enlightenment political science researches have involved philosophy and history and comparative literature. They have cut across many nationalities and cultures. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of California at Santa Cruz, his Master of Arts from Balliol in the University of Oxford, and also his PhD from Balliol, University of Oxford. His awards and honors are numerous. He was a Thomas Jefferson Junior Fellow of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation, University of Virginia. He received the Young Teacher Award of the university. His research grants and travel grants have been numerous. I would mention among them the special grant for outstanding academic achievement at Balliol College, University of Oxford, also the Service Award at the University of Oxford, and the Distinguished Award for Outstanding Teaching from the Taylor Institute of the University of Oxford, various grants that have supported his research in France and elsewhere. And incidentally, this matter of winning honors is something in which he early became quite practiced, having won highest honors to an undergraduate at the University of California, Santa Cruz, in 1976. He's affiliated with many organizations that attest to the breadth of his interest. He is the author of many papers which attest to their depth. He is at present a member of the faculty in the Woodrow Wilson Department of Government and Foreign Affairs here at the University of Virginia. He has taught at the University of California, at Oxford University, at Princeton University, and at Stanford. His articles, just to go through a few of these to show you the diversity, Political Romance and Political Satire, Political Narratives and Approach to Political Culture, Politics, and Tragedy, Four Studies in the Comic Tradition of Western Political Thought, Politics and the Arts, Tocqueville and the American Revolution, Sacrifice and Domination in Aristotle's Practical Philosophy, Rousseau's Sexual Politics, the Politics of Paradiso, Philosophy as Divine Comedy, reflecting his interest in Dante, as does the article, the lecture, Dante or Shakespeare. He is the author of a soon-to-be-published book on Rousseau and his interpreters. Altogether, it is the record of an Enlightenment man, and he therefore is particularly qualified to enlighten us today on his topic, French Constitutionalism, Liberalism, and Democracy.
Very much. That's very kind of you. The principles upon which a constitution is founded are the wellspring of democratic government, individual liberty, and human rights, unquote. As indicated from the first line of the announcement for this conference, it is at least in part to an articulation of these principles that we gather together in marking the bicentennial of the French Revolution. Not unlike the values of liberty, equality, and fraternity that were proclaimed by the revolution itself, democracy, individual liberty, and human rights have often been seen as harmonious components of modern constitutional politics. Rather than composing a harmonious foundation, however, there has been and continues to be an elemental tension between democratic freedom and individual liberty in both French and American political thought. This afternoon, I'd like to explore this tension. I should say that I've only been at the University of Virginia for 3 years, so while I feel compelled to use Mr. Jefferson, I don't feel entitled yet to quote him. For that reason, I will, at least as a kind of subtext to what I will be saying, suggest two different interpretations of Mr. Jefferson's work. They are both somewhat contentious interpretations, and I look to scholars in the room to help figure out which might be the most correct. Anyway, in Federalist 49, Publius praises Thomas Jefferson for displaying, quote, a fervent attachment to republican government, an enlightened view of the dangerous propensities against which it ought to be guarded, unquote. In the balance of Jefferson's writing, there may well be a tension between his republican and enlightened views. Redescribed, such a tension may be found in terms of Jefferson's advocacy of both liberal and democratic conceptions of liberty. For example, Richard Rorty has recently argued that as the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, Jefferson demonstrated a profound liberal concern to accommodate the plurality of values within society. On the other hand, as Hannah Arendt suggests, Jefferson undoubtedly held an equally fervent attachment to the spirit of democratic participation and local autonomy. In what follows, I'll investigate this tension using what Sir Isaiah Berlin once called the two concepts of liberty. In analyzing the relationship between these two concepts, Berlin claims that the value of individual liberty is distinct from the desire for democratic rule. Indeed, he tells us, quote, "The desire to be governed by myself, or at any rate to participate in the process by which my life is to be controlled, may be as deep a wish as that of a free area of action, and perhaps historically older. But it is not a desire for the same thing. So different is it, indeed, as to have led in the end to the great clash of ideologies that dominates our world," unquote. Translated into dramaturgical terms, Berlin sees a condition of tragedy inherent in the relationship between democratic and liberal conceptions of liberty. In his influential lecture on Hegel's Aesthetics, A.C. Bradley captured this sense of tragedy when he said, "It will be agreed that in all tragedy there is some sort of conflict, conflict of feelings, modes of thought, desires, wills, purposes, conflicts of persons with one another or with circumstances or with themselves. One, several, or all of these kinds of conflict, as the case may be. The essentially tragic fact is the self-division and intestinal warfare of the ethical substance, not so much a battle between good and evil as a battle between good and good." Now, setting aside for a moment the rather extravagant Hegelian assumption that there exists an identifiable ethical substance in virtue of which opposing moral claims find their essential unity, This conception of tragedy as ethical conflict nevertheless reflects the structure and character of the conflict of liberty often discussed in the literature on the ancients and the moderns, a very important Enlightenment controversy. For example, just as Jonathan Swift had described the war waged on that fateful Friday in King James Library almost a century earlier, in the works of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Benjamin Constant, a battle is fought between the ancients and the moderns, between two visions of freedom set within two opposing historical models of society. In Constant, we find a champion of individual liberty, an advocate of limited sovereignty, and an admirer of modern commercial society. In Rousseau, on the other hand, we find a theorist of absolute sovereignty, a proponent of political liberty, and a critic of modern society. According to Benjamin Constant, it was common at the end of the 18th century for authors like Jean-Jacques Rousseau to imitate the virtues of the ancients. In his interpretation of the social contract, he posed what is really quite an interesting question. He asked, what would happen if Rousseau's conception of liberty appropriate to ancient society was applied to modern conditions? Throughout all of Constant's works, his answer was essentially the same. Rousseau's theory would result in political tyranny. For example, in his Principe de Politique, Constant maintained, by the way, the Principe de Politique was published when Benjamin Constant was a counselor to Napoleon in 1815. In his Principle of Politics, for instance, Constant maintained that the social contract, quote, so often invoked in favor of liberty is the most terrible support of all kinds of despotism, unquote. Again, in his essay on conquest and usurpation, written while he was a vast critic of Napoleon earlier, he reiterated his opinion that, quote, the subtle metaphysics of the social contract is capable in our days of furnishing the arms and pretexts of all genres of despotism. And finally, in his essay on ancient and modern liberty, Constant again set out to demonstrate that, quote, the most illustrious philosophical system of Jean-Jacques, transported in our modern times, would furnish the most terrible pretext for tyranny, unquote. Now, Constant never argued that Rousseau had himself advocated a despotic form of government. Rather, he argued that Rousseau's philosophical system, his key definitions and concepts, furnished a pretext for despotism in the modern age. Constant repeatedly tells us that he did not want to join those detractors who turned Rousseau into a theorist of a revolution or tyranny. He believed that the goal of Rousseau, who imitated the ancients, was noble and generous, unquote. But in the hands of the revolutionary terror, and in the hands of the supporters of Napoleon, Constant claimed Rousseau's philosophy provided a justification for the, quote, infinite misery and odious measures of tyranny endured under these regimes, unquote. Now, why did Constant believe that Rousseau's ancient conception of freedom was so dangerous to the modern age? To answer that question, we have to place Rousseau's understanding of freedom into the context of Constant's sociological analysis. His analysis began as an attempt to articulate the social structures associated with a set of different historical models of society. On the basis of these models, he went on to relate particular versions of political and ethical concepts to the structures under which they could be institutionally enforced. The main methodological premise underlying Constant's work is that ethical ideas and political choices are constrained by the historical development of social conditions and institutions within which these ideas and choices are to be enforced. In other words, Constant argued, social conditions limit the political choices and ethical standards appropriate to a particular historical epoch. As a corollary to this thesis, he added that the ethical standards and political choices of one historical age are often inappropriate and dangerous when applied to the social conditions of another historical period. Throughout his work, Constant was most concerned with identifying the ethical conceptions of liberty that correspond to the social conditions of ancient and modern societies. In specific reference to Rousseau, he claimed that it was no mere coincidence that the conception of moral freedom found in the social contract embraced many of the themes found in the ancient conception of political liberty. In Constant's view, ancient liberty, like in Rousseau's social contract, was based on an idea of collective self-determination and an understanding of the citizen's identity as inseparably bound to the community as a whole. Among the social conditions of the polis that could lend institutional support to this ancient conception of political liberty, Constant included considerations of the size of the polis as a small face-to-face community, the homogeneity of the community, which provided a tradition of shared values and expectations, the political economy of ancient life based on war and institutionalized slavery, the social organization of the polis with its simple division of labor and relatively equal distribution of property among the citizenry, and the political organization of public life founded on a conception of absolute sovereignty. In contrast to this ancient conception, Constant declared, quote, true modern liberty is individual liberty, unquote. In his view, there is a part of life which necessarily remains personal and independent, which rightly is beyond the competence of society. That is, he believed, individuals in modern society, quote, possess rights independently of all social or political authority. These rights include freedom of person, opinion, worship, property, and against arbitrary governmental power. Such, unquote, such rights may be classified as civil liberties, the individual's liberty to pursue and define their ends for themselves without interference by others. Politically, these rights, quasi civil liberties, must be guaranteed by a constitution which prevents the authority of the state from transgressing individual freedom. For thinkers like Constant, Rousseau's political society must be considered despotic, for it does not provide a constitutional guarantee for the rights and liberties of the individual. It is despotic because it requires that individuals identify themselves as indivisible parts of the state, of the fatherland. Such a self-conception would endanger human freedom because it would ensure that individuals would be denied any possibility of identifying themselves and their ends in their own way. By submerging their identity in the community as a whole, they would be left with no other possibility than to choose the ends which the state prescribes. To have only one choice is not to choose, but to be forced to submit to a life over which individuals exercise no choice over their goals. Now, no place is this overwhelming authority more evident than in Rousseau's claim that the collectivity may force its citizens to be free, to force individuals to act in accordance with a specific goal, even if that goal is as noble as political participation, is to deprive them of their liberty. Although one may want to appeal or persuade individuals to accept their civic duty to participate in government, one can never force them to be free. For by the very act of compelling citizens to participate, one would, by definition, deny them their liberty to define their own ends without interference or constraint. Thus, Rousseau's dictum, on la force d'être libre, one can be forced to be free, does not reveal a paradox, but a simple and dangerous contradiction. But it's not only in the political realm that the despotic character of Rousseau's state is revealed. Even more importantly, in the social realm, human beings are deprived of any meaningful conception of individual liberty. No doubt it is true that individuals, as subjects of Rousseau's state, may be free to pursue their particular ends as long as they do not transgress the laws emanating from the general will. But they have no rights that are beyond the jurisdiction of the state, that are protected from the state's authority. According to Rousseau's theory, the state can interfere and constrain an individual's activity in the most private of matters. And to whom do individuals complain if their personal freedom is threatened? Who else than to the state? So, while it is the state that deprives its subjects of their freedom, it is also the state to whom individuals must complain of such deprivation. Thus, in Rousseau's theory, the individual has no recourse against the power of the state's authority, no constitutional limits, no guarantees, no protected rights. In sum, the individual in Rousseau's state is deprived of freedom at every avenue without any place to turn. Politically, the state forces its citizens to choose the single path of public service, and socially, its subjects are denied a guaranteed realm in which to pursue their own ends without interference. Benjamin Constant put these rather common liberal complaints into a more sophisticated form when he concluded that Rousseau's conception of political liberty, appropriate to the social conditions of the ancients, could provide only a pretext for tyranny when applied to the modern age. In this way, rather than a vision of true human freedom, Rousseau's portrait of society provides modern thought with a model of tyranny and despotism. On the other hand, when seen from Rousseau's point of view, the concept of individual liberty may well appear as a form of social enslavement, sustained by modern institutional structures of inequality and human estrangement. It is to Rousseau's defense against the claims of individual liberty that I now turn. For Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the social oppression of individuals in modern society takes place on results from the loss of their public life. Without the firm commitments and ties to the community in which they live, modern individuals increasingly become, quote, strangers both to themselves and to others. The vast space of the world created by the institutions which support modern liberty, he tells us, turns out to be a vast desert for the individual. As Constant himself declared, modern liberty is concerned with the individual's private happiness. For Rousseau, emphasis on private happiness as the social goal of individual's liberty excludes from the realm of freedom those human convictions centered on a public and collective life. With the loss of public life, human beings become part of a society in which, quote, everyone thinks of his own interest and no one of the common good, and in which the interests of individuals are always opposed to one another, unquote. Absorbed in their private interests, such individuals become increasingly withdrawn from the sphere of politics. They no longer identify themselves with others, but in separation from others. Indeed, in Rousseau's view, it is not the human commitment to a political life, but the institutions supporting individual liberty that are responsible for the loss of human freedom. For Rousseau, the oppression of the modern individual takes place on two levels, the political and the social. First, in the political sphere, human beings are denied their liberty to guide their life according to their own ends, insofar as their liberty does not entail the act of choosing the laws which govern the state. In Rousseau's theory, the legitimacy of the state is based on what he called the principles of political right. According to these principles, the power of the state can only be legitimate if citizens accept their duty to participate in the legislative process. In other words, Rousseau tells us, quote, one must not confuse what is appropriate with what is necessary, simple duty from narrow right, and what can be required of us with what we should do voluntarily, unquote. While the state cannot require citizens to participate, he argued, they nonetheless have a duty to determine for themselves the laws which guide the state, a duty to collectively control their common destiny. In other words, if an individual refuses to participate, Rousseau never suggested that the state can compel that individual to engage in the political life of the community. Rather, he argued that by being unwilling to participate, such a person would thereby relinquish the duties necessary to attain moral freedom. Moreover, he claimed, a state in which such refusal to participate is widespread is in a state of inevitable decline and corruption. On the other hand, Rousseau would argue that if the source of power is not in popular hands, then the state may very well transgress even those principles of legitimacy liberals establish. For example, Constant argued that the legitimacy of the state is based upon protecting each person's individual liberty. But Rousseau would claim that if individuals do not participate in legislation, then those who do exercise the power of making laws could exceed what Constant himself called the proper limits of government. For under such conditions, the legislative authority would promulgate laws to which an individual has not consented. In this respect, the deprivation of the freedom to govern oneself may be considered an infringement of one's individual liberty from the coercion of others without one's consent. For Rousseau, the second level of modern oppression takes place in civil society. I should say about Benjamin Constant that it is clear that while he was working for Napoleon, democratic rule, the idea of people having power to control their lives politically, was not part of his understanding of individual liberty. Clearly, it was just fine for Napoleon to rule. But as long as there was a constitution, which actually Benjamin Constant had written, that would provide for their individual liberty. For Rousseau, the second level of modern oppression takes place in civil society. Indeed, he claimed that even in the social private realm of activity, modern individuals live under conditions which render them incapable of identifying their ends for themselves. Under modern social conditions, Rousseau believed that human beings possessed by amour propre learn to identify themselves in terms of how they are judged or understood by others. Amour propre, in other words, vanity, I suppose, or selfishness, is a conception of an individual within society that Rousseau believes draws the sentiment of one's existence from how others view and judge them. In his view, the identity of modern individuals is inseparably bound to their status as an object of consciousness for others, leads to, quote, a vile and deceptive uniformity in modern society, where all souls seem to have been cast in the same mold. Quote, just as clocks are ordinarily wound up to go only 24 hours at a time, Rousseau tells us, so these people have to go into society every night to learn what they are going to think the next day, unquote. And yet, Constant tells us, these modern individuals are free to identify themselves, to play the parts they choose for themselves. On the contrary, Rousseau exclaimed, actually in his considerations on the government of Poland, today, no matter what people may say, there are no longer any Frenchmen, Germans, Spaniards, or even Englishmen. There are only Europeans. all have the same tastes, the same passions, the same manners, for no one has been shaped along national lines by peculiar institutions. All in the same circumstances will do the same things. You might think, Rousseau declared, that these isolated people living independently would at least have minds of their own. Not at all. They are machines, he says, which don't think for themselves but are set in motion by springs, unquote. Individual liberty does not allow individuals to identify themselves and their ends in their own ways. Rather, the institutions which support such independence create the conditions for the tyranny of modern society over the individual, a tyranny that deprives human beings of their capacity and power to define their identity and ends for themselves. In the end, without a firm commitment upon which to identify themselves, modern individuals both lose their attachments to the life of the community as a whole and, in their isolated independence, fall victim to homme propre. From their own weakness and dependence, such individuals feel a constant need to affirm their self-esteem. For Rousseau, the most common way human beings affirm their esteem is to appear superior to others. Thus, possessed by homme propre, individuals are constantly thrown into an agonistic struggle for social recognition. Quote, homme propre, which compares, is never content and cannot be, because this sentiment, in preferring ourselves to others, also demands that others prefer us to themselves, which is impossible. Unquote. In Rousseau's view, the externalization of homme propre helps to explain the growth of social stratification and inequality in modern society. For example, he argued that under the conditions generated by homme propre, private property and wealth become socially recognizable symbols of human self-esteem because they are quantifiable means by which individuals can judge each other's relative merit. Since homme propre leads each to dominate others so as not to be dominated him or herself, private property becomes a battlefield of competition, and civil society itself becomes a war of all against all. According to Rousseau, the modern state mediates this war by establishing a basis of, quote, legitimacy, unquote, that institutionalizes the inequality of rich over poor found in civil society. In the end, he saw in modern social conditions a vision of social oppression and the formation of government as a conspiracy of the rich. Needless to say, it is certainly not a vision of human freedom. The poor are dominated and enslaved by the rich, and the rich themselves are impoverished and enslaved through their own insecurities and their need to dominate others. In the Contrat Social, Rousseau attempted to define the institutional conditions that would overcome the failings of modern society. In order to overcome the internal estrangement and external oppression inherent in the psychic and social dynamics of homme propre, he believed human beings must both express their freedom as collective self-determination and understand themselves in terms of the principle of communal solidarity. Inspired by the ancients, Rousseau's vision of the civic community was not a blueprint of the future. Rather, it was a portrait of human freedom drawn in sharp contrast to the tyranny of the modern age. Hence, while Constant concluded that the social contract creates the pretext for a tyranny which allows the sovereignty of the people to exist as long as the people themselves do not demand their individual liberty, Rousseau concluded that the liberal conception of the state supports a form of despotism in which modern individuals relinquish their power to define their social and political lives, a tyranny in which they are guaranteed their rights to individual liberty as long as they do not demand their moral freedom, their obedience to laws they prescribe to themselves. Now, so far, the conflict between Rousseau and Constant appears to point to something like moral incommensurability inherent in their respective positions on liberty. By incommensurability, I don't mean that in principle somehow these two positions cannot be articulated in relation to one another. Rather, I mean that in principle there may be no rational terminus to such moral debates. Poised between the value of individual liberty and the demands for political freedom, we may thus experience what Bradley called the self-division and intestinal warfare, which creates the essential fact of tragedy. This tragic conflict is, of course, not confined to either pre- or post-revolutionary France. In contemporary American debate, the battle between ancient political freedom and modern individual liberty has recently been waged by such thinkers as Hannah Arendt and Richard Rorty. In their respective works, as we'll see, each author dramaturgically offers a peculiarly romantic vision of American politics. In On Revolution, Hannah Arendt sharply distinguishes the meaning of political freedom from that of individual liberty. The fruits of the latter, she says, are absence of restraint and possession of the power of locomotion. Even if constitutionally guaranteed, these liberties remain, quote, not powers of themselves, but merely an exemption from the abuse of power, unquote. Even the politically crucial First Amendment, she tells us, is, quote, of course, essentially negative, unquote. Liberties can be enjoyed in private isolation and can exist even without democracy, under a monarchy or in a feudal hierarchy, though not under tyranny or despotism. Now, the, quote, actual and positive content of freedom, unquote, by contrast, is participation in public affairs or admission to the public realm. It requires a political way of life, which means the constitution of a republic. In her analysis of the founding, she persistently identifies with Jefferson's occasional emphasis on direct participation. For example, she summarizes Jefferson's discussion of a ward system modeled after the New England township by saying that, quote, whether Jefferson knew it or not, the basic assumption was that no one could be called happy without his share in public happiness, that no one could be called free without his experience in public freedom, that no one could be called either happy or free without participating and having a share in public power, unquote. In her remarks on the American polity, Arendt offers us a romance of the past. Drawn from the Republican tradition, she portrays the loss of political freedom in America. Firmly anchored in the past, her vision undoubtedly provides a critical perspective from which to view the future of our liberal polity. Indeed, it serves as a warning against current trends towards what Alexis de Tocqueville first described as the condition of modern despotism. In the closing chapters of Democracy en Amérique, Tocqueville wrote, I see an innumerable multitude of men, alike and equal, constantly circling around in pursuit of the petty and banal interests with which they glut their souls. Each one of them, withdrawn into himself, is almost unaware of the fate of the rest. Mankind, for him, consists in his children and his personal friends. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, they are near enough, but he does not notice them. He touches them, but feels nothing. He exists in and for himself, and though he still may have a family, one can at least say that he has not got a fatherland. Over this kind of men stands an immense protective power which is alone responsible for securing their enjoyment and watching over their fate. That power is absolute, thoughtful of detail, orderly, provident, and gentle. It would resemble parental authority if fatherlike it tried to prepare its charges for a man's life. But on the contrary, it only tries to keep them in perpetual childhood. It likes to see the citizens enjoy themselves, provided that they think of nothing but enjoyment. It gladly works for their happiness, but wants to be sole agent and judge of it. It provides for their security, foresees and supplies their necessities, facilitates their pleasures, manages their principal concerns, directs their industries, makes rules for their testaments, and divides their inheritance. Why should it not entirely relieve them from all of the trouble of thinking and all of the cares of living? Unquote. Like Tocqueville, in the human condition, Arendt warns against the rise of the social, the disappearance of the political, and the atomization of privatization of the public sphere. Quote, excellence itself, arete, as in the Greek, virtu, as in the Romans would have called it, has always been assigned to the public realm where one could excel, could distinguish oneself from all others. Every activity performed in public, she tells us, can attain an excellence never matched in privacy. Yet, she laments, quote, our capacity for such action and speech has lost much of its former quality since the rise of the social realm banished these into the sphere of the intimate and the private. Rousseau, by the way, is partially responsible for this banishment. Similarly, in the origins of totalitarianism, she points to such factors as isolation, massification, and the loss of civic spirit as the immediate preconditions for the emergence of totalitarian movement regimes. With her emphasis on the loss of political tradition in the modern age, Arendt may be open to the same objection that Constant raised against Rousseau. As Stephen Holmes put it, by linking totalitarianism so closely with the loss of the political, Arendt neglects the plausibility of Constant's thesis that the most appalling form of modern tyranny may actually contain a distorted echo of ancient freedom, unquote. In Holmes' opinion, quote, she could have corrected this blind spot if she had replaced her simplistic theory of the rise of the social with a theory more adequate to the increased structural differentiation of modern society. Redescribed in dramaturgical terms, the point is that Arendt's romantic narrative of the rise of the social and the fall of the political often betrays the complexity of the historical development of our conceptions of liberty and freedom in terms of our institutional, discursive, and cultural practices. As we'll see, just as Arendt tends to neglect such complexity in composing her Psalm to the Past, Richard Rorty's Romance of the Future may, ironically enough, reflect an all too similar tendency. Unlike either Arendt's vision of the loss of American political freedom or Alan Bloom's closing of the American mind, Richard Rorty does not offer us a romance of, to use his own phrase, a world well lost. While in the past Rorty has called himself a tragic liberal, he has nevertheless consistently endorsed utopian enterprises aimed at expanding one's political imagination through romantic visions of future greatness. Quote, to imagine great things is to imagine a great future for a particular community, a community one knows well, identifies with, can make plausible predictions about. In the modern world, this usually means one's nation. Political romance is, therefore, for the foreseeable future, going to consist of psalms of national future rather than of the future of mankind, unquote. Well, this idea may seem to substantiate the not uncommon claim that Mr. Rorty's work is ethnocentric. It should be noted that in his remarks, he is referring to the national future of Brazil, not the United States. However, in his article, The Priority of Democracy to Philosophy, and in his most recent book, Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, Rorty may be closer to offering just such an American romance, one that dissolves or evades rather than appropriates the problems of the past by cashing in on the liberal hopes of the future. Not unlike the spirit guiding Constant's sociological analysis, Rorty's Psalm to the Future stresses its own historical contingency. Indeed, Rorty uses the term ironist, quote, to name the sort of person who faces up to the contingency of his or her own most central beliefs and desires. Liberal ironists are people who include among these ungroundable desires their own hope that suffering will be diminished, that the humiliation of human beings by other human beings may cease. For Rorty, neither the idle dreams of communitarian politics, like those of Arendt, nor the equally empty hopes of metaphysicians can offer a foundation or grounding for human solidarity. Rather, it's by becoming more sensitive to the often subtle forms of human cruelty that we expand and experience such solidarity. Publicly and politically, Rorty endorses the institutions of contemporary liberal society that attempt to balance the preservation of individual liberty with the prevention of human suffering. Indeed, in what must be read with a good deal of irony itself, Rorty tells us, quote, my hunch is that Western social and political thought may have had the last conceptual revolution it needs. John Stuart Mill's suggestion that governments devote themselves to optimizing the balance between leaving people's private lives alone and preventing suffering seems to me pretty much the last word. Indeed, as, quote, humanity's most precious achievement, Rorty exclaims, nothing is more important than protecting these liberal institutions against thugs and theorists alike. While there is much to be said on behalf of his liberal ideal, I do have some reservations about Rorty's romance. First, for many of us at the University of Virginia, Mr. Rorty's work is pretty well known. First, I'm not sure whether Rorty's notorious arguments about essentialism and anti-essentialism make any difference or all of the difference. Indeed, for Rorty, calling a work metaphysical or essentialist seems to be something of an empty insult. If one thinks that a narrative couched in metaphysical terms is true in the Jamesian sense, then one can just strip it of its metaphysical language through redescription. If one does not believe such a narrative is true, then one can call it metaphysical and essentially drop it. But by definition, a distinction between texts one thinks are good in the way of belief and those one thinks are not good in the way of belief has nothing to do with whether or not a text is metaphysical. To cite an obvious example, even though John Stuart Mill has the last word in his romance, Rorty's utopian politics are nevertheless drawn from the bête noire of anti-metaphysical thinking, Immanuel Kant. Just as John Rawls has shed Kant's metaphysical trappings by canceling the idea of a trans-historical, absolutely valid set of concepts which would serve as philosophical foundations for liberalism, Rorty identifies his own pragmatic romance with the self-fulfilling triumph of the Enlightenment. Indeed, from Rorty's narrative perspective, a non-metaphysical, non-foundational, self-canceling and contingent reading of Kant's metaphysical elements of justice would almost certainly amount to a pragmatic redescription of Rawls' first principle. Recall Kant's universal principle of justice. I ought to act in such a way that my freedom can coexist with the freedom of every other. While justifying this claim for freedom in terms of our historically contingent beliefs, both Rawls and Rorty undoubtedly endorse the fulfillment of Kant's liberal project. Moreover, by de-scientizing and de-philosophizing his enlightened thought, Kant's liberalism converges with that of Jefferson, whom Rorty depicts as a kind of first-rate liberal thinker with some bad metaphysical habits. By stripping away the metaphysical remnants of Enlightenment rationalism, however, both Jefferson and Kant can finally be included in the ranks of such good liberals as Isaiah Berlin, John Stuart Mill, not to mention Benjamin Constant. In this way, while Kant may have led philosophy departments astray for the last 200 years, it seems that Rorty has not strayed too far from an updated American version of Kant's utopian ideal of liberalism. But once we drop the idea that it matters whether a narrative is metaphysical or not, we can, no doubt, offer a reading of our cultural history that is more complex than one that tells of the triumph of good pragmatics over bad metaphysics. As Plato might have been the first to admit, these ideas are, after all, cultural artifacts of human creation, part of the story we tell about ourselves. While it might be therapeutic to remind us of this occasionally, one should always be wary of the problem of countertransference. By focusing on whether a text is metaphysical or not, we may lose the cultural and political significance and value of our narratives. According to Michael Walzer, the diverse understandings of a culture, quote, are frequently expressed in general concepts, in a people's historical ideals, its public rhetoric, its foundational texts, its ceremonies and rituals. It's not only what people do, but how they explain and justify what they do that constitutes a moral culture. Because of the complexity and plurality entailed in this conception of ethical life, Walzer concludes, cultures are always open to the possibility of conflict and contradiction. To illustrate Walzer's point, one need only to look to the conflict of liberty. In defense of moral pluralism, Rorty follows Berlin in arguing against, quote, all telic conceptions of perfection. In approaching such metaphysical concepts, Berlin warns, to block before man every door but one, no matter how noble the prospect upon which it opens, is to sin against the truth that he is a man, a being with a life of his own. However noble his own remarks, as contingent, our vocabularies of freedom are not, of course, restricted to either Berlin's conceptual scheme of negative liberty or Arendt's positive scheme of political freedom. Indeed, as pluralistic, our linguistic uses of liberty and freedom are often conjugated in terms of our distinct cultural and historical understandings of such values as agency, autonomy, democracy, community, and virtue. As historically complex, these distinct conceptions of liberty are often appropriate to different spheres of our historically developed discursive and cultural practices. But by conflating the differences preserved in our use of such terms as liberty, freedom, and democracy, Rorty ironically transforms one of the elemental conflicts within our political culture into yet another romantic presentation of good texts over bad texts, human sanctity over philosophical sin, and freedom over enslavement. In this way, the irony, contingency, and complexity of ethical life may require greater respect for difference than is sometimes found in Rorty's liberal romance. To conclude, I want to suggest a quotation by Martha Nussbaum. To do justice to the nature or identity of two distinct values, Nussbaum reminds us, requires doing justice to their difference. And doing justice to their difference, both their qualitative distinctness and their numerical separateness, requires seeing that they are, at least potentially, circumstances in which the two will collide. Distinctness requires articulation from, bounding off against. This, in turn, entails the possibility of opposition and conflict. The battle between those books written by Hannah Arendt and those authored by Richard Rorty constitutes the most recent eruption of the conflict between liberal and democratic conceptions of liberty and freedom. In this way, just as it may well have been captured in the writings of Thomas Jefferson nearly two centuries ago, in contemporary debate, there undoubtedly remains a vital tension between our desires for individual liberty, the value we place on moral plurality, and the demands of our political freedom. Thank you.
Thank you. That animated pursuit of truth would be very much not only in the Jeffersonian tradition, but the Enlightenment tradition in general. Since you propose that those who've devoted themselves to the study of Jefferson make some comment, I wanted to say something that occurred to me, and then we might see what occurred to other people, and I will introduce the other members of the panel in just a moment. You yourself declined to pigeonhole Mr. Jefferson, but you mentioned those who in a very self-satisfied way proclaimed him to be a liberal. Well, in my book, Thomas Jefferson, A Strange Case of Mistaken Identity, I examined some of the contradictions of the man, and these contradictions are not always as evident in him as they are in some people who have considered him. Like most people of very great mental capacity and also a fine sense of balance. He is not easily pigeonholed. I found that it would be very difficult to call him either liberal or conservative. For one thing, what constitutes a liberal or conservative varies very much from time to time, and we don't mean just over the centuries. Consider the Vietnam War. At first, people who favored United States intervention in Vietnam were called liberals. But before the war was over, people who favored continued intervention by the United States in that war were called conservatives. So these things change. However, some recent surveys of scholars and public figures who classify themselves as predominantly liberal or conservative has revealed that Thomas Jefferson possessed some characteristics that could place him in either camp. His concern for individual liberty, some people would say, placed him in the liberal camp. His concern for public education, they would say, placed him in the liberal camp. On the other hand, he believed the central government should not be strengthened unless it was absolutely necessary, that government was best if you could keep it closer to the people. And then he said something else that many people would consider heresy now. He said he wanted to increase the number of informed voters. But he said it's a very bad thing if we increase the number of voters by adding people who are too ignorant to understand the choices. The thing is to give as many opportunities as you can to people, educate them as well as you can, and then encourage them to exercise the franchise. Well, I'm just mentioning this to show how difficult it is to pigeonhole that gentleman. And Dr. Brent has said many things that will stimulate discussion today, I'm sure.